Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. This week, conversations with Spokane Poet Laureate Chris Cook and Inland Northwest Opera General Director Dawn Volsky, both key figures at the intersection of pandemic and the arts. Dan Webster offers his take on a documentary that explores the winning is everything mindset of contemporary politics, and we get some soothing sounds from our studio, courtesy of guitarist Jacob Johnson, whose playing takes us in. This is Northwest Arts Review.
We last heard from poet Chris Cook in what feels now like a very different world. It was October of 2019, and he'd just begun his two-year term as Spokane's Poet Laureate. Cook, who is an award-winning performance poet, professional musician, and professor at Gonzaga University, was full of enthusiasm and ideas for events and collaborations he was looking forward to hosting as Poet Laureate. Of course, the COVID-19 crisis has thrown a huge wrench into all those plans, but Cook's enthusiasm is undiminished. Chris Cook joins me now to talk about what it's like being a civic poet laureate in the time of quarantine and what ideas he has in the works. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Chris.
Obviously, you're most well known as a performance poet, and you're such an advocate of the performance scene in Spokane. What's it been like continuing to advocate for that, and how have you helped stay engaged with that community in this strange time?
Yes, well, we have continued via Zoom meetings to hold a three-minute mic, Auntie's Bookstore's First Friday Poetry Open Mic, which I host, as well as another long-running poetry open mic called Broken Mic, which was normally at Nito Burrito on Wednesday nights. I'm co-hosting that. And so that's a weekly event and then a monthly event with three-minute mic. So it's being done virtually. And, you know, I have to say it is a great haven for being able to see friends from all over the country, actually, without their masks. Mm. And so there is a little silver lining there. But the numbers are definitely down. It's not the same. But for poets who want to join us from, in our case, Florida, New York, Denver, Texas, we've had people joining us from everywhere, and so Zoom facilitates that.
Yeah, I guess that is the silver lining, that people can be part of Spokane's scene even if they're no longer or never lived in Spokane.
Right. Yeah. And we have so many young poets who go to school elsewhere, and so this affords them the opportunity to stay with us.
Yeah, neat. So I went back and listened to our interview back in October to sort of remind myself of what your grand plans were as Poet Laureate. So you talked about a couple of things that have probably changed at this point. So one of them was you had ideas about an open call themed project around Spokane's neighborhoods. Is that still continuing in any way?
That is unaffected by COVID. And so that's something we can pull the trigger on anytime. Yes, that's kind of my big dream, is to have an open submission anthology of poems about the theme of Spokane's neighborhoods, published in book form. And I had originally intended to do that in the second year of my laureate term, but there's no reason not to do it sooner. As you mentioned, I play with the Spokane Symphony, and we are a phase four organization, yeah, as is live poetry. So no time like the present.
Yeah. And that brings up the other idea that you brought up, which was you're a member of the Spokane Symphony, and you talked about doing some collaborations with poetry and music. And we've heard elsewhere on Northwest Arts Review that the whole Spokane Symphony season has been postponed to next year. So are you hoping to still continue that collaboration?
Absolutely. And I was approached by the symphony who wanted to commission me to write a new poem in celebration of our 75th anniversary, which would have started next season. But as you say, we've been delayed by a year. And so that 75th anniversary or that 75th season will, it looks like, begin in September of 2021. I was fortunate to get in under the wire and perform with my colleagues at the Knitting Factory, however, and so I did get to live that dream. Mm. My poetry was accompanied live by instrumental music as part of the M show that our concertmaster Mateusz Wolski produces and stars in.
Okay.
So that was very gratifying.
Yeah, neat. It's been interesting to see on the Poetry Moment, our poetry show on KPBX, we've had several poets bring new poems that they've written during this time of quarantine or in response to racial justice protests or, you know, in other ways, just sort of responding to current events. I'm curious, what do you see as the role of poetry in difficult, challenging, unprecedented times like this?
Yes, well, question is, and it depends on the poet, do you face it directly or are you a harbor? Is it an escape vehicle in the same way that we use music, you know, poetry without words? And so I've found myself spending equal time either escaping through poetry or venting through poetry. So I have been writing. I've got some new poems, one of which was just published in a recently released anthology, and that's a Spark Central project. And every poem is about a different bird done by regional poets. And I also had a big hand in the Inlanders poetry issue that came out during COVID, but all the material was written prior to COVID, so we really had to make some adjustments. But I wrote an essay and a brand new poem for that issue, and so that was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And I was able to also continue to teach and to maintain my communication with several schools where I was giving video assignments and receiving them back in video form as well, but coaching and assigning and doing what I could to continue the educational outreach despite COVID.
Yeah, neat. Well, you mentioned you have been writing and publishing. Did you bring any poems that you'd like to share as that sort of in response or recent that you've written?
Absolutely. Here's a recent one, although it was barely pre-COVID. And so that's why you find me on an airplane at one point in this poem. The Kaylee. I'm on an airplane reading Jonathan Johnson's The Desk on the Sea, a gorgeous memoir honoring his mother, written during his year in Scotland with his wife and daughter. It's his ancestral home. It's also where my roots lie. Heather, brambles, gorse, the old sod. Jonathan writes that renewal is visible even in the winter. December has begun. Somehow the roses in front of our cottage are still blooming. I learn of traditions where the school children, now including Jonathan's daughter Anya, participate in poetry recitation day, in choral singing, and in dancing at a gathering called the Kaylee. The parents and grandparents in attendance, once school children themselves, watch as another generation steps forward. The flight is returning us home from our son's wedding, the gathering of generations. It's February, but in San Diego, the flowers don't care, blossoming in defiant glory. At the ceremony, I handled the poetry recitation, though Rob and Alyssa's self-written vows were beautifully poetic. During the reception, all ages danced to Earth, Wind, and Fire's September, our full-throated voices singing, "Do you remember?" Later, when newer music replaced the old, it felt right to step aside, leaving the young to dance.
That was my guest, Chris Cook, reading his poem, The Cayley. Chris Cook is the author of two collections of poetry, The View from the Broken Mic and Damn Good Cookie. He's currently serving as the City of Spokane's Poet Laureate. Chris, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for asking, Chris.
For obvious and very good reasons, we've experienced a very long period of drought when it comes to live performance from KPBX. We're slowly and cautiously emerging from that dry spell, and recently enjoyed a live guitar hour hosted by Leon Atkinson and featuring a young, very accomplished guitarist, Jacob Johnson. From that broadcast, here is Jacob playing a transcription of a Franz Schubert song. Lob der Tränen, In Praise of Tears, a song by Franz Schubert, played as a guitar solo by Jacob Johnson, as recorded in our KPBX studio. I'm Jim Tevenin, and this is Northwest Arts Review, also available as a podcast at SpokanePublicRadio.org. The documentary Boys State gives a view of how politics so often resorts to the winning is everything plan, says Dan Webster in this review.
We're now immersed in the run-up to the 2020 presidential election, and each of the two main political parties is attempting to portray itself in the most positive light possible. Yet it would be hypocritical for either party, Democrat or Republican, to claim that it is the party devoted solely to honesty, integrity, and truth. Both parties do make such claims, though, despite the historical evidence. Whether it be the big city machine politics of New York's Tammany Hall or the corrupt administration of Warren G. Harding, just to name two of many examples, both parties have shown an enduring devotion to a winner-take-all school of politics. And you have to wonder, what is the genesis of this social Darwinian attitude? Did it start when people still lived in caves and the general rule, at least among some tribal groups, was that only the strong should survive? Or is it something that evolved gradually, growing in tandem with the development of civilization, tethered to the ideology that some people are just better than others and thus deserve more? At its most basic, those are questions that documentary filmmakers Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss tackled with their film Boy State, which is streaming through Apple TV+. McBain and Moss center their film on the 2018 Texas Boys State Convention, which was where 1,000-some high school-age boys from all over the Lone Star State congregated in the capital city of Austin. Part of a national program that was begun in 1935 by the American Legion, a girl state was formed 2 years later, Boy State is intended as a kind of training ground in democratic government. We watch as the boys board buses and begin to socialize. And from the very first moments, they start to practice their respective brands of politics. At least some of them do, which is how McBain and Moss frame their narrative. True to the aim of every good documentary filmmaker, they focus on a few interesting participants, each of whom ends up playing a role in how both the convention and the film finds its own resolution. One of the participants, Ben Feinstein, is a double amputee, but instead of being what you might expect, an advocate for the disabled, he is a fan of self-help. One who reveres Ronald Reagan and who, as the film goes along, shows perhaps the most astute feel for winning politics, however dubious a distinction that might be. At the other end of the political spectrum is Stephen Garza, the son of a Mexican immigrant who comes to Austin wearing a Beto O'Rourke t-shirt and whose message is a blend of support for Bernie Sanders and for sensible gun control, the latter in particular not a particular stance in Texas. Then there's Robert McDougall, an all-American guy who seems as if he stepped off the set of a Richard Linklater film, Dazed and Confused, anyone? And whose political stance is somewhere in between Feinstein and Garza's, though nowhere near as well-conceived as those espoused by either one. McBain and Moss shape their film chronologically, taking us day by day through the week-long convention, showing how the boys are split into two groups, nationalists and federalists, how they are directed by the few adults who show up on screen to elect party leaders, come up with a party platform, and work to elect members of their group as overall boys' state leaders. The main position is that of governor, a slot that Garza, McDougall, and others vie for, and which the political operative Feinstein, who belongs to the Federalist Party, and his main foe, the national party leader Rene Otero, try to snare for their respective candidates. We get to see all this unfold with the filmmakers, aided no doubt by the skillful efforts of editor Jeff Gilbert, interviewing each of the principals, their comments sometimes directed at the camera, sometimes included as voiceovers, and that unfolding, which includes an attempted coup aimed at dethroning Otero and a fair amount of testosterone-laced venting, occurs with far more drama than that offered by either of the just-held national presidential nominating conventions. Yet the message remains largely the same for all, which these politicians in training learn well, and which reflects the famous statement by Al Davis, late owner of the one-time Oakland Raiders, "Just win, baby." Just as telling, though, is a comment made in the film by Governor candidate hopeful McDougall, one that gives an even better indication of how the process works, and likely always will. "Sometimes you gotta say what you gotta say in an attempt to win," he says. "That's politics." For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Movies 101 host Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com. Movies 101 is heard Friday evenings at 6:30 on KPBX and Saturday afternoons at 1 on KSFC. Opera, Just the name conjures up images of elaborate sets, sumptuous costumes, fine orchestras. But currently, opera is an art that relies most heavily on the heart of the form, great voices. Someone with a deep knowledge of all things operatic is Inland Northwest Opera General Director Dawn Volsky. We chatted earlier in the year as Inland Northwest Opera was charting a course through pandemic-roiled waters. Now we'll check in with Dawn about how one specific plan worked out.
I can't believe it feels like I just talked to you a week or two ago, and time travels differently in COVID, I think. So yeah, we spoke in April just before we were launching our summer operagram, and essentially what the operagram is think of the singing telegrams from 100 years ago. It's not something I realized that happened. We knew that there were telegrams that were delivered, but occasionally, instead of reading the telegram or delivering something written, people would sing them. And so we were sort of the opera version of this summer, and people could sign up and select, you know, their preferences of date and time. We did them through the weekends, on the weekends throughout the summer, and you'd get a personally delivered little concert, mini concert. So two arias and added happy birthday or something if it was a special occasion. And that was our operagram for the summer. We actually just completed them last weekend, though I will tell you that if we have a special request, we do still have a few regional artists who are willing to continue to do operagram. So while the program has officially come to a close to move on to the next phases here with the opera, you can still get an operagram. Just to clarify on there, they would be socially distant. So the artists remained a minimum of 15 feet away. And once the regulations changed in Washington, at least, we requested that all of our patrons wore masks as well, and they were 100% outdoors. So it was a way to enjoy live music from a safe distance where no one was having to worry about the logistics of navigating this new virus that we're dealing with.
And some of the more torrid scenes are now automatically a lot more chaste, given the distance that was kept. How many singers?
Well, I'll tell you what, for an opera singer, you want distance anyway. I mean, you can actually have your hearing damaged if we're an opera singer were to resonate directly into your eardrum. You know, singers, when they're on stage, we have to angle our faces away from each other a little anyway so that we don't hurt each other. So we were uniquely positioned because you want to enjoy opera from a little bit of a distance anyway. We had a great response this summer.
Good. And how many singers were involved?
Well, let's see. We had five singers that did the majority of our operagrams. Three of them are based here year-round, and two have family here, and were back in town for a little bit this summer. And then I had to make a special appearance one weekend as a sixth singer when one of my singers got sick, because we take that very seriously. Mm-hmm. Slightest symptom, we don't send our artists out. So, and then we didn't use a pianist. We had orchestral tracks that would play from a wireless speaker. Mm-hmm. So they'd just come and think of, you know, old school boombox, set down this orchestral recording and sing Nessun Dorma or something really lush. We went with some of the most well-known moving repertoire, including Queen of the Night aria and a lot of fireworks from one of our artists, some really lyric things from another, and very successful. And it was exciting. We were lucky to be able to find a way to make our opera portable. We called it INO on the go. Mm-hmm. And so we would head out and kind of think of opera on wheels.
Well, I'm wondering if when this eventually does settle down into whatever degree of normalcy might come over us eventually, if this is something that you would just consider making part of the way that you do things, just make it part of the INO process.
Absolutely. That's our plan. I mean, I think one of the things that have been a gift during this time is we've had to think outside of the box and say, okay, what are some of the things we can do that would be different that we wouldn't have done before? Like these hand-delivered, personal, intimate opera situations. Opera we think of, you know, as being grand, and it is. It's the most expensive art form out there because it incorporates the choirs and the principal singers and the orchestra and actors and dancers. And yet the essence of what we do is trying to connect with people one-to-one. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is not something we would have necessarily thought of in previous years. And now that we have, we definitely want to keep it. And so it's looking at, you know, what can we do differently during this time, but also what can we keep? What can we learn and bring back? So the response, I'll tell you, one of the things I was thinking about this before we got on our call, you know, when you get into a situation like this, obviously the first things we all worry about are the basic human needs, right? We're worried about food and shelter and, you know, the things that we absolutely need to survive. And historically, whether or not it's true, historically, arts are kind of considered to be a luxury. And a lot of people didn't really realize how much they missed live art. And then we would get out into these people's front yards, or they'd be on their back deck and we'd go around the backyard. And there was not a single operagram situation this summer, and we did them weekends all from mid-June to mid-August, where we did not have tears. We had people, I actually started to tell people, you're going to want to have your tissues out. Even myself, people forgot how much we are moved by live performance. And that was so affirming and so moving for me, you know, and for my husband as well. We see these things, we forget how important arts are to our everyday life when we're, you know, just in the weeds, like you said before.
Sure.
And so it was kind of amazing to see the reactions and be reminded that what we do matters.
We'll check back with Dawn Volsky in a couple of weeks to hear her ideas for Inland Northwest Opera's future. Meanwhile, you can check their website, inlandnwopera.com. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Help today came from Chris Massini. Thanks as well go to Chris Cook, Dawn Volsky, Dan Webster, and our guitarist Jacob Johnson, who plays us out. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.